developed in my mind and in my heart this last week or two. And the words that some of them come from history, words I've used and never really thought actually what the words mean. And I mean the word yesterday that was added to the list was transformation. And all these words that have been coming are to do with change. And this is another one that's to do with transform. Change the form of. Now, we are creatures of familiarity and sameness. We get a lot of our security from that, which is not. It is understandable, because we all like to feel secure, and we get security from the familiar things around us. When we put in for unfamiliar circumstances and situations and surroundings, we can feel uncomfortable, which is not necessarily a bad thing at times, but if it's all the time, then it can be quite a problem. But this thing of transformation links in with other things that have become. Look back in the history of the church, particularly British history. I'll just go through the other two or three words that were fought in that. One is Reformation, Nonconformist, and Protestant. Things that are to do with religion, as I thought, and I had some understanding vaguely of them. But Reformation is reformation, reforming something. Back in the 1500s, a chap called Martin Luther challenged the church over the direction it were taking. And it were getting very materialistic in a lot of ways, the church, and he was trying to bring them back onto a sensible footing. And it was a radical change. Went on about little bits of change, and it resulted in two changes. Now, we call that sort of about Wesleyan Reformed Church and things like that. You know, what's it mean, reform? And Protestants do. We've heard a lot in the Irish situation between Catholics and Protestants. The Reformed Church is what it says, a reformed church, formed out of what was, but it becomes different. It takes the, hopefully, takes the bad away and puts the good in, where things have gone wrong. Now, the Protestant church is, again, it's a word made up of a statement. It's a protest. It came out of protest. They were protesting against the Roman Catholic Church. The protest people became labelled as protesters, hence the name Protestant Church. All these around sort of 1500s, 1600s, going on. My history is not very good at all. I actually went and had a look on the internet through the inquiry things there, just to try and find out a little about it. Because these things had come to me and I didn't know what they were. I'd heard the words and I knew how they linked in now to, you know, Protestant churches, yeah, Wesleyan Reformed churches, you know, the names are there, but I didn't really know why. So I got a little bit of a clearer thing. But The thing that sort of set this off was, I got something for last Sunday to share, and it was linked in to the statement of non-conformist, and then it widened to these other things. But the non-conformist, now I've got a big thick book that would make a good doorstop, or if you've got a table leg short, it'd fill a gap about that big. And it's called Matthew Henry's Commentary. And he's somebody from the 1600s, and he did a Bible commentary, and it's really big, and it's, you know, you look through this and you go, I, V, I, and all that sort of numbering, all the Roman sort of things. So it gets a bit, it's a bit of a difficult one to handle. And I've had it a long time, I've used it occasionally, but I never really knew who Matthew Henry was. And it turns out that Matthew Henry was a non-conformist. Now, the non-conformists are linked into the Protestants because they were dissenters. The non-conformists were dissenters from the Church of England. And it was one of the main factors that resulted in the English Civil War that took place in this country, in your land. So there's, yeah, I mean, there's lots of religion is linked in very strongly to our history, and we have terminology now that quite often we don't know where it really comes from. It'd be interesting to do some sort of studies and look back into that. You know, I mean, we see the D-Day remembrance and that the other day, and we're now sort of 60 years on, and it's lost on us to some extent. But when you hear some of the people that has come through that, and it's 60 years ago, we are here now because of what they did then. Now, you know, it could have been happening now. What would our commitment have been in that situation? We've no idea. We've no idea. But in this nation, I think there's been a deterioration in the strength of belonging. I don't know whether it's the isolation that we tend to live now compared to then, because we have isolating lives. Television's an isolator, computers are an isolator, locks on doors are an isolator. There's many things that cars are isolators. So many things that isolate people from one another. And if you go back 60 years, certainly the communities in this area, which had a strong mining link, had a very strong community sense, a sense of belonging. So you had a common pulling together when there were problems, when there were troubles. So these words all came out, I said, they had in 1662 there was an act passed, and it was called the Act of Uniformity, and it effectively ejected those that were in opposition. Then these became known as the non-conformists. There's all sorts of things, you know, wrapped up in our history. And at that point in time, you know, we talk about church splits today, but at that point in time, nearly 2,000 clergy left the established church. Just think of that, one point in time, 2,000 go. You know, we talk about church splits and fallouts today. But that's just a little bit of a background. What I want to just share with you is two instances in the Bible of non-conformity. I think of, sometimes we think of non-conformity as being rebellion against authority. But it's not necessarily that. I want you to turn to Daniel. And the beginning of Daniel. Now Daniel was brought up in two separate upbringings in a way. He was brought into the house of Judah, but he was brought up as an Egyptian. He had two sort of cultures thrown at him, but his roots were back in his birth nation. Now he was brought up in the royal household and of the Egyptians, and if we read chapter 1 verse 8, he had a choice, or he was given the chance to have the best that man could give in his upbringing. And in chapter 1 verse 8 it says, "But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank." Now this is the king's household, the best of everything available to Daniel, all he could wish for, the same, you have it. But he sought permission from the commander of the officers that he might not defile himself with that food. He didn't see that food as beneficial. But he asked permission not to eat that, but in its place to eat what he felt God was telling him that he should eat. It says, "Now God granted Daniel favour and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, 'I am afraid my lord the king has appointed your food and your drink, for why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king.' But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, 'Please test your servants for 10 days and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink.'" So in place of all the king's fancy stuff, he will eat vegetables and drink water. Daniel knew that he did not want to conform to the natural ways of man. He knew he didn't want to do it. He knew a better way. But Daniel did not outright refuse. He asked permission to go that better way. And he knew that God would prove him in that better way. Now this was not a fallout with the king. He was not separating himself away from the king, because if you read further on, he became a very important man to the king. He knew that his right living would be better served by eating vegetables and drinking water than all that the king's natural resources could provide. So Daniel decided he would be a non-conformer. He would not conform to the king's ways, to all that the world says is the best things. Daniel decided that he would have what God had given for him and his nation as being the best food and the best course of action. And Daniel knew that he would be vindicated in it as well. He wouldn't have to insist, because he'd be able to prove. You know, we've gone, in our household, we've gone on to a Carol Vorderman diet, a detox diet. Now, Pauline and our Louise, they've tried various sort of diets, restrictive diets. You know, you don't eat as much and you end up starving. But this detox diet is very much a vegetable diet. In fact, it is entirely a vegetable diet. And there's some good stuff in it. And do you know what? They've lost weight. And do you know what? They're not hungry and starving. And they're feeling better probably now than they after a lockdown. They've lost a good amount of weight. They're getting all that they need, food-wise. And it's good. Now, that's just in the natural, that. But you see, Daniel had got this. See, he didn't need a Carol Vorderman diet book. He'd got the answer there. Now, the natural times then would say, no, nobody eats better than the king. You know, if you won't get at his table and eat all his stuff, why? Whoa, look at that. You know, dinosaur steaks and the lot. You'd be in there. Plenty of wine to drink. Oh, yes, you'd be in there. But it wouldn't have produced in Daniel what he needed to become. He didn't want to become what the king's produce would have produced in him. And Daniel and his mates, they shone. They kept to their diet and they went through and they shone. And they did not conform to the natural. They had a supernatural way. And Daniel stuck to that. Now the interesting thing as well in this further on, because Daniel had three friends, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, and they had another situation cropped up where they also were put in a position of having to say, we will not conform, we will be non-conformists. If you turn to just to chapter 3 in Daniel, now the king Nebuchadnezzar builds this big statue, and it is a big one. It's a massive gold statue, and he sets it in the middle of the plain, and he says, everybody has got to bow down to this statue. He'd give what they called the king's edict. It was a law that everybody had got to bow down to this statue. Now we've got a different type of non-conformity cropping up here. This non-conformity is an I'm not conformity, because they were being asked to do something that was absolutely, absolutely wrong. They were going to bow down to a golden image that man had made and worship it as God. That was the idea. That was the whole idea of setting the statue up. And they said, we cannot do that. And we will not do that. I will read that in Daniel chapter 3, I think it's verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Now that is non-conformity, that. That is non-conformity. Absolute, I am not. Because they knew that that was completely wrong. The whole idea of it was wrong. So we got from Daniel the non-conformity where he was asking permission. Now we've got the situation with non-conformity by I'm not. And we've looked at it from the point of view of man when I say non-conformity. But it was conformity, actually. It was not conformity. If you turn to Romans chapter 12. Verse 2 it says, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect." See, do not be conformed to this world. Be a non-conformist. It can take courage to do that. Because we have all sorts of peer pressures. No matter what your age, what your situation, you will have peer pressure to conform. A number of years ago, there was a lady around that got laughed at, scoffed at and joked at. And her name was Mary Whitehouse. And the reason she got laughed and scoffed at was that because she saw what was coming in the television industry. She saw it a long way off. And it came in as a thin wedge. Now on the television we have swearing, we have sex, we have violence, to the extreme that they wouldn't have put them on the X films on the cinema screen a few years ago. Now it's on the television. And you can watch a programme on the television, and anything after, I don't know, what is it, 8:30, whenever what they call the watershed. And you cannot be sure after that time that you will not get swearing and things at some time. In any of the programmes, you can be watching a live broadcast or something, or an interview or whatever, and it can crop up anywhere. And the trouble is that we have been sucked into it. We have to some extent been conformed to the world. Because we accept now what we wouldn't have accepted a number of years ago. So, you know, to be not conformed to the world is a wide, wide thing in our lives. It covers right across. But it says there, it says in that verse 2, it says, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing." Now that transformed, I mean, it's the same word that you get fashioned from. Do not be fashioned. Conformed. Do not be fashioned to this world, but be transformed. Transformed is the metamorphosis. You know, like a caterpillar turns into a butterfly. Metamorphosis, it changes. We're going away from this world's ways and we're becoming God's ways. It's a transformation, and it's happening in the mind. Because it's in the mind that the world is trying to grab hold of us. It's in the minds, it's in the systems of the world work on the mind. All the emotional, the social, the things that appeal to the eyes and so the things that are working through the mind. And God's telling us, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Be non-conformist as far as the world's concerned. Be conformist where God's concerned. Because we can change our perception of things if we can stand back and look from God's perspective. Because our own perception is tainted. Our own perception of things is tainted. If you turn to Romans chapter 8... verse 29, there's another little statement there. Well, read chapter 20, verse 28 as well. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose, for whom he foreknew, he also predestined to become conformed to the image of his Son. See, it's talking about in the positive. Right? We've looked in the negative in terms of the man's viewpoint. But here he's talking to be conformed to the image of his Son. That's to become likeness, getting the like image of Jesus. He wouldn't have stood by and let the things happen that we stand by and let happen. You know, the world's got this idea, and the church has been sucked into it. Keep religion out of politics. Religion's nothing to do with politics. Well, you'll go back to when Moses was around, and politics and religion were the same. It wasn't separate then. It's man that separated it off. What we need is God in politics. Not politics in religion. That causes enough trouble as it is having politics in religion. But we want religion in politics. And when I say religion, I don't mean man's terminology for religion. I mean we want God in politics. God in this nation's politics. We want to be transformed into the image of God's Son. We want to see things from his perspective. Turn again to another one in Philippians chapter 3. Verse 10. That I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed to his death. Mm-hmm. We become part of his death. We're going to become part of his life. We've been round the table, right? We joined in him in that. So as he took the death pain for us, we're now drawn up to him in life. That I may know him and the power of his resurrection. You know, they're powerful words, and we can't see him half the time. In Romans chapter 6 verse 5 it says, united with him in the likeness of his death. Now that word conforming to the image of Christ, conforming. I got a definition out of the dictionary which really sort of nails it, I think. It's to form according to a pattern, make similar. Jesus is the pattern. Not the world that's the pattern. That's what we tend to follow. We live day by day, and you know, I mean there's so many subtle ways in which the world will grab our attention that way. Andrew was a pattern maker, and he knows when he made a pattern, what come out will be precisely what the pattern was. So our pattern is in here. Our pattern is Jesus. He is our pattern. And when you take a pattern and you're going to make something metal from that pattern, you'll pour in the hot molten metal. And that'll fill the mould, right? And then you get out the image from the pattern. And of course, if we're the metal being poured in, it means we've got to be heated up. Yeah. We've also got to be allow ourselves to be poured into that mould. But the thing is, when we do and when we allow that to happen, what is going to come out is something according to the pattern. And if God's made the pattern, it's going to be a right thing that comes out, isn't it? If the world's made the pattern, then it's not going to work. I think Andrew related it to us once that he had a teacher at night school. I didn't mind just telling this one. He had a teacher at night school. And this teacher at night school, it was something to do about a pattern. And was it to do with folding of paper or something, to make a pattern anyway. And this teacher said, it's not possible. It is not possible for a man to do that. Well, Andrew proved him wrong. Andrew proved that there is a way to make the pattern and make it perfectly. And he took it to the teacher, and the teacher, I think the teacher still went on after saying it weren't possible. But you see, the Bible says that what is impossible to man is possible to God. So if we can get into God's mould and let God do the moulding in us, then he'll produce something that man could never produce, no matter how many times he tried. You know, I knew I was going to be speaking today before we were sharing last week, and I've shared to you really what I'd got for last week, but along the way I was also preparing something for today, and it does link in, because I looked at some of the patriarchs and that went along, Abraham and Joseph, Elijah, David and others, and there's some interesting things about them, because they were conforming to God. And then you'll see a little bit further along the line, and suddenly they conform to something else. But God's not let go of them. All of these fulfill the potential. Yeah. If you turn back to Moses, we're going to Exodus chapter 2. Now, here's Moses. Moses knew he was called. He was called to set the people free. Set the people of Israel, set them free. And here he is on his starting blocks. I'll go for it. So it says in chapter 2, verse 11, it says, "Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labours, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, then he saw that was no one around. He struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand." His job had started, his calling had started, he was there, but somebody had seen him. The next thing you see, Moses is legging it. Now, Moses could have gone, he could have looked at it from the world's point of view and said, "I've gone wrong, it's all a load of rubbish, that's it, forget it." Or he could have waited. And what did he waited? His time wasn't right. He was going for it, thinking, right, this is it, I'll go all guns blazing. And he fell flat on his face. But God hadn't finished with him, because he got it wrong. God got hold of him, and over those intervening years, God would have prepared him. He'd have been preparing him. And there came a day when Moses got it right. He was bang on target, bang right, and did the right thing. Abraham was another one. If you go out into Genesis chapter 12, you've got Genesis there, Abraham there rather, Genesis chapter 12 verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. He ups and goes. How many of us would just up and go? Say goodbye to everybody, leave your house, leave everything. Oops. Just go, just, you know, I mean, it takes some doing that. We're more mobile now than he was then. But, I mean, he'd have to take all his cattle or whatever else. That's faith that did that. But you read 10 verses later on. What is it? Verse 11. And it came about when he came near Egypt that he said to Sarah's wife, now, you know, you're beautiful, you. When they see you, they will say, you know, they'll be wanting you. So, say you're my wife. I was trying to praise you then. I'll read it. And it come about when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is my wife, and they will kill me, but they won't let you live. Please say that you are my sister, so that may go well with me because of you. He's launched out in faith, left his entire family, gone just where God had directed him, taking only what he needed. And 10 verses later, he can't even trust God to protect him and his wife. You know, he's just dropped over the edge. And these are mighty men of God. We look back at these as mighty men of God. But you see, God again didn't leave him. Abraham had raised up in faith, believed God and gone for it. And then he'd fallen down in fear, because of fear of losing his wife to in that situation. But God didn't let him go. God kept on with him. God had given promises, and God were intending to fulfill those promises. Another one, Joseph, Genesis chapter 39. Now he's one that was done the dirty on a couple of times. Favourite in his father's household, his brothers hate him, they're jealous to death of him, they were going to kill him, and then they decide to sell him off as a slave into Egypt. God prospers Joseph in Egypt. He becomes a vital man in Potiphar's household. And then what happens? I mean, he's gone through all this business of going into slavery. He makes good from that. And then he's in Potiphar's household. Was it chapter 39, verse 20? This Potiphar's wife trying to entrap Joseph. So Joseph, now it came to pass when Master heard the words of his wife, which he spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, that his anger burned. So Joseph, master, took him and put him into jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there, and he's innocent. He hasn't done a thing. He's been loyal as anything. He's worked hard. He's been as loyal as anything. And he's slapped into prison. What's he to think? Has God left me? What am I doing here? Did everything right, and I've been landed in this. He could have thought all sorts. He kept in prison, I don't know how long he kept in prison, but then he had the two prisoners that had dreams, and he was the baker and the cupbearer, and he interpreted those dreams, and he asked the cupbearer, remember me when you go out, just remember me. That was his ticket to get out. What happens is he's stuck there another 2 years. In chapter 41, first verse, it says, now it happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. So he's got to, as a result of that, he's got to come out of prison. But he's stuck in, 2 years. He's already been in prison for I don't know how long, for something he didn't commit. He's stuck in there then another 2 years after having a bit of hope that he might get out if cupbearer had enough sense to remember him. But he's stuck there again. He could have thrown in the towel good and proper. He could have really said, right, I'm stuffed with that. God must have deserted me. That's it. I've had it. But he didn't. And he's another one that came good again. Because God kept in there with him. God was moving in his life. These people are going through real rough times. Yet, they could have said, I'm out of God's blessing. But they didn't. They kept in there, no matter what the situation was. Elijah, he got to the point, he wanted to die. He thought things were that bad. In 1 Kings chapter 9 verse 1 to 4 it tells you that he says, I want to die, just let me die. But you see, he got his perception wrong, and God had to point out to him that his perception was wrong. Elijah's there saying, I'm the only one left, you know, what can I do, I'm the only one left. And God had to point out, I've 7,000 reserved for me, you're not the only one. He's got his perception all wrong. And we get our perception wrong sometimes. We get our view of things. Sometimes it's like we look through little tunnel glasses, and that's all we can see. And when we're in pain, it can get even worse, because the concentration gets even worse. And I told you about the arm and that way. All your concentration goes to where it hurts, and your whole body's in sympathy. David, another one, served Saul the king, and he served him loyally. David was in covenant with Saul. Even Saul didn't realise that, but David was in covenant with him, and David loyally, covenantly, strong, served the king. And I think there's two occasions where Saul, in his hatred for David, slings a javelin at him to try and kill him, to the extent that David has to run away. It wasn't all good and plain sailing, you know. He had some real rough patches, David, and that was one of them. But God brought David, he brought him good into victory. Peter, into the New Testament, Peter, he'd gone through a lot, Peter, all the trauma of the crucifixion and Jesus dying, and he must have been so confused because his understanding wasn't complete even then. And he goes back to what makes him, or he thinks makes him feel secure. That's his fishing. Go back to his trade renewal. The thing was, though, it didn't make him feel secure, because he couldn't catch anything anyway. Until God came on the scene. But you see, it was his perception. I've got nothing to hold on to. I'll just go back to my fishing. Thinking that he could hold on to that, but even that wasn't there. There's a fallout between Paul and Barnabas over Mark. They have a violent fallout, and I'm not sure which way around it is. Paul doesn't want to take Mark. That's right. So Barnabas takes Mark. They have this fallout. Mark, he disappeared and left us before. We're not having him again. So, I mean, what's the Mark feeling like? Well, they're squabbling over him. It's not who wants him in the team, it's who don't want him in the team. If you look later on in 2 Timothy chapter 4, you'll find that Paul specifically asks for Mark. Mark comes good. Mark's had the trauma and whatnot of this fallout with Paul, but things come good. Mark's kept in there. He's held on. Now, Paul, I mean, the things Paul went through. Well, he was beaten, imprisoned, in the inner prison. I mean, they have a prison cell, and I think it's like a hole in the floor that's another prison locked in. So, I mean, if you suffer from claustrophobia, I would imagine that's really not the place to be. But Paul's in that situation. There's conspiracies to kill Paul. He's shipwrecked. He goes through all that. But he never thinks that he was out of God's blessing. He never thinks he's lost it because things have got rough. And he's gone through all that, and he's still looking forward to completing the race, finishing the course. The thing was that in the time when the circumstances were failing, the faith didn't. Although the natural circumstances seemed to be against them, and man was so intent against them at sometimes, that their faith was there through it all. And no matter what happened to them and around them, they just kept in there, and they all made it. They all made good. Now, any time they could have stopped and said, that's it, and drawn a line, but none of them did. Because if they'd have drawn the line, what else was there? I mean, Peter tried to go back to fishing for the moment. He didn't find anything. And none of the others would have found anything. Even though Elijah, at the point of time, felt he was completely alone, God reawakened his God perspective, because he'd come down to a natural level and were just seeing through the little view that he had, as if he was the only one. Now there's a passage in Deuteronomy chapter 31 verse 6 that's repeated again in Hebrews chapter 13 verse 5. And it's, be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or tremble at them, for the Lord your God is the one who goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. So whatever circumstances you're going through, whatever problems you've got, whatever difficulties arise, there's a real powerful promise that God's putting into your life and into my life. when he said be strong and courageous, he's not saying we're being cowards. What he's trying to do is just get our attention back onto the right viewpoint. Because like some of these sometimes, particularly like Elijah, we can feel that we've got it wrong, we're on our own, nobody understands, and we go into self-pity, which is what Elijah were doing. So God's reminding us, be strong and courageous, do not be afraid or tremble at them. Now them could be anything in your life, all the Goliaths in your life. For the Lord is your God. He's the one who goes with you. Now, God never left these people. All the circumstances and the difficulties, the times when they felt alone, the times when they felt they were at rock bottom in the situation, God never left them. He says, He will not fail you or forsake you. He will not. None of us. He will not fail us or forsake us. Now I've got here Psalm 27:14. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. If there's any time we need a promise to hold on to, it's now. There were times when they had to wait for the Lord. Moses rushed ahead, trying to get it sorted. Peter was very impetuous. He'd run on and try and run ahead. Wait for the Lord. Be strong. Let your heart take courage. A bit earlier, when we were praying around these, there was something I felt the need to pray over them. And I think, I've scribbled it down because I think it's something that we all need to pray. I'll read it out, and then I think we should stand up and say this together. And it's a short one. It's, Lord, accomplish in my life what you have set out to do. Not a long prayer, not a difficult one, but it's profound because it means everything. So will you stand up and we'll just pray this together. And I think we'll say it a couple of times. Might get it into our system now. Hallelujah. Lord, accomplish in my life what you have set out to do. Lord, accomplish in my life what you have set out to do. Amen. Amen. Amen.